Lunar Orbit Rendezvous. The history of Project Apollo can be divided into two parts. Before 1962, June the 7th, and after 1962, June the 7th. I will explain why later. My story this evening is related to the struggle between three concepts of how to get to the moon. But first, some precursor ideas. Humans had long thought of travel to the moon, but it only became a realistic proposition after the Second World War. It was never going to happen without public understanding and support. To that end, Wernher von Braun and others began a long campaign to drum up that support. Part of that campaign were a series of articles in magazines such as Collier's in 1952. Remember, this was 5.5 years before Sputnik. The plan was to assemble the lunar fleet in Earth orbit. Some plans called for a huge space station from which the lunar missions could be launched and to which they could return. This would mean the winged shuttles would not need to fly to the moon. The rockets leaving Earth would be huge. Willy Ley supported von Braun's vision. The caption to one of the Collier's magazine read, "A historic moment, man's first landing on the moon. The lunar rocket ship is about to touch down. Its motors are being turned off, and the shock-absorbing central landing leg, visible inside the rocket flames, is just above the moon's surface." This view, with the distant Earth in the background, was painted by artist Chesley Bonestell from the perspective of a man standing on the lunar North Pole. End of quote. With the space station built, assembly of the lunar fleet could begin. There would be a cargo ship and a passenger ship. Because these craft will not land on Earth, there is no need to carry heat shields to the moon. Now, I can count 20 men and no woman on the picture I'm looking at of the lunar spaceship. Outdoing Elon Musk, the three lunar landers make simultaneous descents to the moon. Once down on the moon, the astronauts get busy with Caterpillar track rovers. The first stay on the moon would be 6 weeks. The article says that the landing legs are jettisoned soon after takeoff to save weight on the return trip to Earth. Von Braun's grandiose visions even extended to fleets of spaceships heading off to Mars. Well, since we all know the end result of the Apollo mission mode controversy, a bit of timeline history won't give any spoilers. On 1957, October the 4th, in the Soviet Union, Korolev launches Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite. 1 year later, on 1958, October the 1st, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is formed in the United States. A week later, Project Mercury is officially established. Within days, Keith Glennon established a space task group at Langley under Robert Gilruth to work on Project Mercury. And Mercury was a one-manned spacecraft. Then, in 1959, Rosen and Schwenk begin to sketch out a possible lunar mission. Already in 1959, the idea of a landing stage and an ascent stage was clearly set out. The lunar ascent rocket would be detached from the command module before atmospheric entry. At the same time, the United States Army was exploring lunar landing concepts. On 1959, October the 21st, NASA formally acquired Army's Saturn project. That's the rocket project. This action followed much argument. The Army reluctantly acquiesced for two main reasons. First, to prevent the Air Force taking over the von Braun team. And secondly, because the Saturn booster had its primary place in space exploration and not in the Army missile program. During 1960, NASA was preparing to implement its long-range plan beyond Project Mercury. This included a manned circumlunar mission that was, as yet, unnamed. Then, in July, a NASA headquarters group recommended that NASA plan a lunar landing to be made sometime after 1970. On 1960, July the 28th, NASA's Director of Spaceflight Programs, Abe Silverstein, announced that the NASA manned circumlunar mission would be named Project Apollo. The mission was based on a proposal by General Electric. General Electric's proposed craft was shown off to the press by James Webb and George Lowe. As related in the official NASA history book by Helen Wells, Susan Whiteley and Carrie Carrigans, the name Apollo had an appeal for a number of reasons. Apollo was the Greek god of poetry, music, prophecy, and archery. The naming was following the precedent of using mythology, as set by the Mercury Project. On 1960, September the 8th, President Eisenhower visited the Redstone Arsenal, escorted by von Braun. Late that year, President Eisenhower's Science Advisory Committee reports that a manned lunar landing was feasible, but that it would cost between $26 and $38 billion. Remember, that was in 1960. But Eisenhower refused to approve any manned program beyond Mercury. In 1960, NASA held a design competition for a lunar craft. One submission from the Martin Company was to be a direct ascent mission with a lifting body crew compartment to allow a controllable re-entry to the Earth's atmosphere. By 1961, Rector of General Dynamics was showing a modified version of its Apollo circumlunar spacecraft. Now, it's interesting to note that Apollo 13 did eventually fulfill the original plan for Apollo to make a circumlunar mission. That's a mission that just goes out to the moon, round behind it, and straight back to Earth without going into orbit around the moon and without landing. In 1961 February, George Lowe's committee says, and I quote, "The manned lunar landing mission could be accomplished during the decade at a cost of $7 billion through fiscal year 1969," end of quote. Early in the Kennedy administration, Lyndon Johnson took control of the Space Council and persuaded James Webb to head NASA and talks Kennedy into emphasizing space. On 1961, May the 25th, Kennedy gave a speech to Congress that was to change the course of history. The Apollo project changed from a circumlunar one to a landing one. The problem was, no one at NASA or elsewhere had any idea how to do it, much less before the decade is out, which everyone assumed was the end of 1969, not 1970. Depending on how you count decades, the first decade of the current era had only 9 years. Late in 1961, contracts for major Apollo program elements were signed before the lunar landing mode had been decided. Even so, three main Apollo mission types were planned. One thing was obvious: there would now be several variants of the Apollo spaceship. At the end of 1961, plans to develop the Saturn C3 and the Saturn C4 were cancelled, constraining the possible mission modes of getting to the moon. This cancellation also reduced the chances of constructing von Braun's cherished space station. From 1961 through to mid-1962, there were vigorous discussions and arguments about the mission mode for Apollo. On 1961, December the 7th, NASA Associate Administrator Robert Siemens announced the Gemini project. Its aim was to develop the technique of rendezvous in space. The original concept had been called Mercury Mark II. In 1962 January, von Braun made a lecture tour of Australia. Now, one engagement was at Sydney University, where he answered student questions. Well, back in America, by 1962, June the 7th, von Braun officially accepted lunar orbit rendezvous by concluding a long meeting with the proponents of various mission modes by saying, "Well, gentlemen, I have listened to the arguments. I'm proud of the work you have done. Now, I'll tell you the position of the center," by which he meant the Marshall Space Flight Center. The decision on mission mode was made on grounds that were as much political as technical. And I'll return to that assertion. On 1962, July the 11th, the decision to use the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous mission mode for Apollo was announced. On 1962, September the 11th, President Kennedy toured the Redstone Arsenal, guided by von Braun. And von Braun even got to ride in the presidential limousine during the royal tour. And Vice President Johnson was there as well. And reporters, expecting that this was to be a simple photo opportunity, were astonished to hear a vigorous discussion on the Apollo mission mode. Von Braun was briefing the president on the Lunar Rendezvous mission when Jerome Wiesner interrupted von Braun, saying, "No, no, that's no good." Webb immediately defended von Braun and Lunar Orbit Rendezvous. The adversaries engaged in a heated exchange until the president stopped them, stating that the matter was still subject to final review. Not close enough to hear exactly what I said, the reporters nevertheless heard enough to report there were still serious disputes about how to get to the moon. On October the 24th of 1962, James Webb visited the White House to tell President Kennedy that it was his firm intention to let the Lunar Excursion Module contract to Grumman Aviation. Either that, or Kennedy might like to consider accepting his resignation as administrator. So the Grumman contract was awarded in 1962 November. And that contract was for the designing and producing the Lunar Excursion Module. So this changed the mission mode decision from tentative to confirmed. On 1963, November the 16th, President Kennedy again visited Cape Canaveral Air Force Station, this time with von Braun, and inspected the Saturn I rocket that was being prepared for the Apollo Saturn V mission, which was placed in orbit on 1964, January the 29th. In 1966 June, the name Lunar Excursion Module was changed to Lunar Module. Now, some writers have incorrectly said that this was because the word excursion sounded frivolous, as in an excursion to the beach. Actually, it was because the word implied mobility on the moon, and this vehicle did not have that capability. From 1962 through to 1969, the design of Grumman's lunar module evolved over time. There were different designs in 1962, 63, 65, and finally in 1969. But the story of all those changes is a tale for another day. Well, we come up to 1969, July the 21st, Australian Eastern Standard Time, when Apollo 11 lands on the moon. Well, do you remember that tipping point I described, the 1962 tipping point? It had long been recognised that von Braun's grandiose plans, as set out in the Collier's magazine, were not possible. This is a book that I bought for 15 shillings in 1961. Little did I know then that the first human lander of the moon would be named Eagle, the same name as the book. In it, there is an alternative way to land on the moon, as proposed by the Convair Company. And this reminds us, when you look at the detail of the Convair proposal, reminds us of the way the Curiosity rover landed on Mars. And the Convair craft would have been lowered on strings. Others were proposing a mini von Braun-type vehicle that could transport lots of cargo to the moon, then blast off directly back to Earth. In 1961, employees at Langley, which was where the Mercury project was run from, proposed sending a modified Mercury craft to the moon. Not only that, they also planned to then get the astronaut to pilot his contraption down to the moon. In 1961 November, Harry Schoaf of the Space Task Group Engineering Division proposed a lunar lander, which was to be used with an advanced version of the Mercury spacecraft. And one of the Langley group was a guy called John Hubolt. Hubolt's original proposals were unrealistic. He calculated a mass of 6,800 kilograms for a pressurized lunar module and 1,140 kilograms for an open platform. The joke went around that the astronaut should wrap an aviator's silk scarf around his neck as he landed on the moon in an open platform. Well, there are five main ways to land on the moon and return to Earth. Only two of these were under serious consideration in 1961. First, direct ascent. You blast off the Earth directly to the moon, land, explore, then blast off with enough energy to come directly back to Earth. The rocket men at Huntsville liked this idea. Bigger rockets for them to build. And direct ascent would require the huge Nova rocket. This would have a mass of 5,900 tons and a liftoff thrust of 180 meganewtons. Although I have seen other estimates of the mass and thrust for this giant rocket. For comparison, the Atlas was the largest rocket then available, with a thrust of 1.6 meganewtons, and the later Saturn V used 33.4 meganewtons to lift 2,767 tons off the launch pad. Well, the Nova project was seen as having the advantage of simplicity. However, the disadvantage was that it would be needed to ramp up the thrust available by two orders of magnitude. Another disadvantage of Nova was the huge cost, and a third disadvantage of Nova was there is no chance to check out the spacecraft after launch because you are already on your way. A single direct lift to the moon could have been achieved if the Saturn V was hydrogen-fueled in all stages and the crew was only two people. But hydrogen was, in 1961, an unproven technology. By the way, there's another disadvantage of the Nova project, and that is the landing and return vehicle would be so heavy that it might break through the lunar crust or sink deeply into the lunar crust. Remember, back in 1961, no one knew quite what the surface of the moon was like. And that was until Luna 9 landed there in 1966, January the 31st, and Surveyor landed in 1966 on May the 30th. And another disadvantage of the Nova direct to the moon plan was that a tall stack might land on an uneven surface and topple over. Oh, and another disadvantage, yes, there's a whole list of them here. The crew lying on their backs some 60 metres above the tail would have a lack of visibility when landing. And another disadvantage, Nova would take 10 years longer to develop than the Saturn V. Now, another mode, another way of getting to the moon. And that was Earth Orbit Assembly. Later, it was called Earth Orbit Rendezvous. And this mode had its advocates. And that was to build the entire mooncraft in Earth orbit by sending it up in pieces on smaller rockets. Then fly directly to the moon, as in the direct ascent plan. The disadvantage was that the precise timing of multiple launches needed to achieve rendezvous was not guaranteed. And remember that neither manned nor unmanned rendezvous had been achieved in 1961. Another disadvantage of the Earth orbit rendezvous method is that this method had all the disadvantages of the direct method in that the lunar landing vehicle would still be as ponderous. But the Earth orbit rendezvous method could conceivably use lots of Saturn I's or the Saturn C5 then being planned. And John Hubolt calculated that 10 Saturn I launches would be required. But there was an advantage to Earth orbit rendezvous. There would be no need to build the Nova. Another advantage of the Earth orbit assembly was that a space station in Earth orbit would be one spin-off of the method. This was the favourite of von Braun, a long-time advocate for space stations. The problem was still how to bring the payload mass down so that it could be flown on the Saturn C5, so the cost was still very high. Several variants of the Earth orbit rendezvous method were proposed. One favourite was to launch one or more unmanned tanker rockets into Earth orbit, then launch a manned Apollo to rendezvous and replenish its fuel before setting course for the moon. Now, cryogenic propellants are those that are very cold, like liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen. And cryogenic propellants are tricky to store and pump here on Earth. But in the weightlessness of vacuum, no one had any idea, because it had never been done. And this mission would need two Saturn V launches for each mission, another disadvantage of the Earth orbit rendezvous or assembly. And so we move on to another mission mode, which was called Lunar Surface Rendezvous. And that involved landing a cache of fuel and supplies on the moon with an unmanned rocket to await arrival of a manned spaceship. The Nova would not be required, as the mission could be accomplished with two Saturn V's. However, this method, Lunar Surface Rendezvous, did have some disadvantages, and let's run through them. If the payload of the unmanned rocket were damaged, there would be no return ticket for the astronaut. This damage might not be apparent until the crew arrived on the moon. Another disadvantage was that the astronauts would spend much of their time on the moon doing the refueling, with very little time left for geology or other science. And if liquid oxygen were used, it would have a limited lifetime. If the astronauts landed too far off target, they would be unable to reach their supply base and refuel. Remember, Apollo 11 overshot its target by 7 kilometres. Author Piers Brizzoni summed up the situation thus, and I quote, "As 1961 drew to a close, the problems of the direct ascent approach had become painfully obvious. the upper stage of the lunar rocket, about the mass and length of a Navy destroyer, would have to land on the moon stern first without toppling over and then take off again without the benefit of a launch gantry or ground crew. It was also a challenge to work out how the astronauts sitting on top of this monster were supposed to pilot it down safely to its touchdown when they couldn't see the moon through their windows. They'd have to ease the ship down using rear-pointing TV cameras or some such. And Brizzoni continues, when over-optimistic sketches emerged showing the rocket landing on its side on skids, that signaled the end of the ball game for direct ascent. And Brizzoni asserts that, and I quote again, Von Braun and his team at Marshall preferred Earth orbit rendezvous not just because it seemed safer, but because it also guaranteed them a greater technical role in the lunar voyage itself, rather than just blasting hardware away from Earth. End quote. In 1916, a Russian mechanic named Yuri Kondratyuk was considering how to travel to the moon, and he wrote, I quote, the entire spacecraft need not land, end of quote. He expanded this in a self-published book in 1929. Unaware of Kondratyuk's work, Dr. John Hubolt was pondering the problem. He was a relatively obscure engineer working under Gilruth at Langley Field. His regular work was in aerodynamics research. Already, his one-man concept had been laughed at a court, so many regarded him as a joke. However, he began to study orbital rendezvous techniques. Then the idea struck him. Did Columbus have to drive his vessel up onto the beach in order to set a man ashore in the New World when a long boat was ample for the purpose? He asked. He scribbled rough but workably accurate estimates of mass factors on an envelope. He later refined the calculations and typed them up for a report. He had discovered the mass at launch could be cut approximately in half. Ergo, a single Saturn V would suffice for each mission. Hubolt began a long campaign to proselytize his ideas. He was able to calculate the probabilities of mission success for each of the mission modes. While the naysayers included von Braun, Max Faje, and Kennedy's powerful advisor, Jerome Wiesner. Hubolt wrote to NASA Associate Administrator Robert Siemens on 1961, May the 19th, outlining his concerns. Most of that letter had to do with launch vehicles, but it also mentioned lunar orbit rendezvous. Hubolt received a brief note of acknowledgement from Siemens, but no action ensued. Just days after Kennedy's speech to Congress, Hubolt drew a sketch, which is now known as the To the Moon or Bust drawing. In it, Hubolt shows that it would take 10 Saturn I launches to loft into Earth orbit the components for a manned lunar landing. In this concept, 2 one-man lunar landers would be flown on the same mission. In another drawing, Hubolt considers 2 one-man landers launched by the later cancelled Saturn C-3 rocket. In the following months, Hubolt prepared a detailed report setting out the rationale for lunar orbit rendezvous, supported by detailed calculations. And this was delivered to the NASA management on 1961, October the 31st. And he continued his crusade to gather converts. On 1961, November the 15th, Hubolt again breached protocol by writing directly to Webb's associate administrator, Robert Siemens. Hubolt felt he had to defend himself from accusations that he was a crank. It is not clear whether Hubolt included a full copy of his October 31 report with his letter, but it is clear that parts of it at least were attached. In his 1971 book, Earthbound Astronauts, Bjørn Lai wrote, and I quote, "Siemens was sufficiently impressed and disturbed by Hubolt's outburst to bucket onto his director of manned spaceflight, Brainerd Holmes, not perfunctorily, but with a request for serious evaluation." Holmes promptly dispatched his newly appointed deputy, Joseph Shea, to Langley. By the time Shea left in early 1962, Hubolt was in the end zone for a touchdown, cheered on by supporters who now numbered nearly everyone in NASA except von Braun. Back in Washington, Joe Shea's favourable report on Lunar Orbit Rendezvous was followed by several months of computer analysis on a national scale. By the end of June of 1962, mountains of data from computers had carried the day for the bug approach. Gilruth presented his conclusions on 1962 July 5 in Huntsville to von Braun. There had been a long-standing antagonism between von Braun's rocket-oriented camp at Huntsville and Gilruth's pilot and aviation-oriented camp at Houston. During 1962, Joseph Shea had tried to get the Manned Spacecraft Center and the Marshall Space Flight Center to work together. According to writer Michael Neufeld, and I quote, "Max Page of the Manned Spacecraft Center told Shea to get lost," end of quote. Neufeld says, "Fage was never able to satisfactorily solve the problem of how to land the big Earth orbit rendezvous vehicle on the moon. Originally, the lander was 27 meters long. Fage even proposed a lunar crasher stage. This would be a module under the command service module that would contain enough propellant to slow the craft into lunar orbit, then lower it from lunar orbit down to near the surface before jettisoning it at low altitude separations. With astronauts lying on their backs, visibility was, of course, still a problem. The basic concept for lunar orbit rendezvous was as follows. Fly a two-part spacecraft on a Saturn C5 to Earth orbit. Check it out. If it all works well, punch out to the moon. Go into lunar orbit. Separate the lunar excursion module and land it on the moon whilst the main craft remains in lunar orbit. Then the ascent stage lifts off to lunar orbit, rendezvous and dock in lunar orbit, abandon the lunar excursion module in orbit, then punch out of lunar orbit in the main craft and fly directly back to Earth." The question was, could this be achieved on just one Saturn C5 launch? Half the payload mass than Earth orbit rendezvous? Multiple chances to check out the spacecraft and to chicken out should something go wrong. And the cost would be 10 to 15% less than the Earth orbit rendezvous mode. And another advantage is that there's no need to carry Earth entry heat shield down to and back up from the moon. And rendezvous in Earth orbit, let alone in lunar orbit, had not yet been demonstrated, was a disadvantage of the method. With von Braun's objections withdrawn and Fage outmaneuvered, a press conference was organized for 1962, July the 11th, to announce the decision to tentatively use the lunar orbit rendezvous mission mode for Apollo. A 32-page report on this press conference was later published by NASA. But this public announcement did not silence the critics. At the end of 1962 July, the President's Science Advisory Panel struck back. Weisner issued a report criticizing lunar orbit rendezvous as, quote, "extremely ingenious but highly specialized, an isolated development," end of quote. As related in the official NASA history, Managing NASA in the Apollo Era, the report argued, and I quote, If a two-man crew is adequate for the most difficult part of Lunar Orbit Rendezvous mission, then it cannot be persuasively argued that three men must be landed in other modes. End of quote. The panel preferred Earth Orbit Rendezvous because it seemed to offer a greater margin of safety. The NASA history notes that the decision was made on grounds that were as much political as technical. By this, NASA historian Arnold Levine means that the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous idea came out of Langley and, as such, was seen to be neutral between the Houston and the Huntsville camps. As a result of the mission mode decision, the design of the Apollo project evolved. So too did the concepts for the lunar lander. The lander could now be much smaller than required for the Earth orbit rendezvous method. And von Braun never got his Saturn C3 or his C4, but had to be consoled with the Saturn C5. And, well, of course, nor did he get his cherished Nova. And nor did his hopes to continue flying reusable Saturn boosters eventuate. It was up to South African Elon Musk to bring the concept of reusable rockets to fruition. Grumman, after some difficulties and design changes, did succeed at building a two-man lunar module. Hubolt was eventually recognized as the father of Lunar Orbit Rendezvous and the one who changed the course of the Apollo project. Note that he initially called the lander LEV, the Lunar Excursion Vehicle. Writing in 1971, Bernie Lay said, and I quote, "Most experts I consulted now believe that the United States might still today be far from reaching the Apollo goal if any of the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous alternatives had been chosen." When Life magazine was preparing an article on the Lunar Orbit Rendezvous mode, they wanted to use a picture of Hubolt on the cover. However, NASA dissuaded them. At the urging of Neil Armstrong, Yuri Kondratyuk was eventually recognized in his own country, with the result of coins, stamps, and statues honoring him. Today, the lessons of the 1960s are heeded in lunar mission planning. In the same way that John Hubolt analyzed mission modes, today's planners are using his techniques. Both Chang'e 5 and Chang'e 6 from China will use Lunar Orbit Rendezvous to return lunar samples. The Soviet lunar probes used direct ascent from the lunar surface. As for winged spacecraft, well, we did get the space shuttle. It helped to build a sort of space station. The full story of the Apollo mission mode decision is a bit like a maze. Unlike garden mazes, where there is only one solution, this maze has many equally valid pathways, of which I have told you but one. I would encourage you to enter this maze and find your own preferred paths, or to explore the numerous, though fascinating, dead ends. By the way, there is a museum dedicated to John Hubolt in the United States.